Welcome to Microdigressions. This is Spencer Case. Now, if there's one topic that is known to be controversial and highly divisive, you might think it would be Israel-Palestine, which is what I'm going to talk about today with my two guests. I'm here with Craig White. Craig is a former diplomat and the author of Iraq, The Moral Reckoning, and one other book. What's your new book called, Craig? I'm sorry, I forget.
It's called Acts, Intentions, and Moral Evaluation.
Great. And Mark Oppenheimer is my other guest. Mark is a lawyer in South Africa who has argued in front of the South African counterpart to the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. And I know him, and you probably know him too, as the co-host of Brain and Avat alongside Jason Werbelov. I've done many podcasts with those two. So, Mark, it's great to have you here.
Absolute pleasure.
Well, Mark and I are kind of, more than kind of, on the pro-Israel side here, and Craig is much more critical of Israel. So I'm going to try to be balanced in, after having we each do an initial statement, I want to sort of back off and let you two discuss certain philosophical questions about this as they come up. So I suggested we all begin with a little opening statement. So I'll begin with mine. So I want to begin by acknowledging that I'm not an expert on this, and there's really a lot to know. And I should probably acknowledge my biases as well. So, I mean, one thing that Mike Humer says in Why People Are Irrational About Politics is that if you know that you get emotional about an issue, that's a reason to suspect your own rationality about it. So I have to confess, like, this is definitely true with me on this issue. You know, I'm so outraged by the October 7th attacks that I find it very difficult to think calmly and dispassionately about the issue. You know, I think, you know, cast the people who did this into the deepest pit of hell without delay. And I feel impatient with any discussion of moral constraints on the means, even though I know intellectually that there ought to be some. So I want to acknowledge that as a proviso for what I'm about to say. But I was in Egypt. I studied Islamic philosophy. I was there in 2012 and 2013. And I was actually kicked out of one of my apartments and threatened with violence for making a mildly pro-Israel comment. And I was quite shocked at the level of hatred towards Israel and Jews generally that I found in Egypt, in Cairo. And Cairo is a pretty modern city. It's not like it's the worst of the worst of the Muslim world as far as anti-Semitism goes. But there are booksellers on street corners where they would have just a few books, you know, like no more than 20. And you could always find, or not always, but very often you could find Arabic translations of Mein Kampf and Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And people were really worked up about this issue of Israel-Palestine, and to the extent that people would stop me in the street and talk to me about it, want my opinion about it, because they just wanted to express themselves to some American, you know, about how upset they are about American policy towards Israel. And I got into some conversations that I really remember. Probably the most memorable one for me was I was in a taxi cab with a woman who was in a niqab. It's a covering that covers everything but like this, the eyes, with her daughter. And when she realized that I was an American and I could speak Arabic, I can't so much anymore, she just immediately bursts out into tears and she starts telling me, she's like, you know, what the Palestinians have suffered, it's terrible. You need to open your heart to Hamas. Open your heart to Hamas and, you know, and their righteous struggle. And I don't remember exactly what I said, but I made it clear that I will never open my heart to Hamas, you know, like whatever else you convince me of about this issue, I'm never opening my heart to that. But just the casual anti-Semitism, you know, shouting Yehuda or Jewish as a curse word, you know, was common. So I feel sympathetic toward the Jews as a as a people. And those sorts of experiences make me more sympathetic toward them, you know, because they might be in a position of power with regard to the Palestinians, but not with regard to the broader Arab Islamic world. I read this book, Rise and Kill First, recently by Ronan Bergman about the Israel targeted assassination program. It's a very critical book about Israel, very, very critical. And there's lots of terrible stuff that he documents that Israel has done in this book. But one thing that comes through in this is that a lot of the worst of the stuff was curbed by other forces within Israel, journalists, other forces within government, people refusing to carry out orders that have sort of put a check on some of the worst of this, of the things Israel has done. And so I see forces within Israel that moderate its worst tendencies. I'm not sure I see that on the Palestinian side. In fact, I'm not sure I know of any cases of conscientious objection or something like that, of Hamas fighters refusing to carry out an attack on a target that is considered to be an unjust target. But there are lots of these things that have happened on Israel's side. One last point I'll mention here is just something Charles Krauthammer said about this makes sense to me, that the standard by which we should judge Israel should be the standard by which we evaluate Western countries at times of war. I mean, if you think of the way the U.S. has behaved at war, quite terribly. U.S. did some pretty messed up things in World War II, and the U.S. was never facing an existential threat in World War II in the way, say, Poland was. Even compared to like the U.K. So if you imagine the U.S. facing an existential war where we really had reason to believe that our existence as a country was threatened by some outside force for decades, I could imagine the U.S. would get up to some pretty bad things too. And I think this is probably true with every country in the world. So I think that it's fair that that should be our basis of comparison. That's all I've got to say for my opening remarks. I turn it to Craig.
I'll be brief here, since I get to start with the meat of the issue. I definitely find this to be a painful issue. I've partly in my long life, in early adulthood, I was sent as a Peace Corps volunteer to Oman. I went to a small village and worked really hard in my Arabic. I found some very strange things about the Islamic culture in a small town in Oman, but some really admirable things. And so I had a rather positive engagement. But I've always felt myself to be pro-Jewish. Grew up pretty reflexively pro-Israel, actually, just as a normal American. And that got some question marks with one particular Palestinian friend who didn't push the issue very much in Oman, who was married to an Omani woman. So let me clarify now that I've leaped into it. I would say I too am horrified by the attacks of October 7th, and I have no plans to justify them in any way or offer any justification. I believe Israel has the right to exist, but as long as we're sharing my opinion, I think Israel has missed some really serious opportunities along the way with the Palestinians. And I think there's a history that is important and that is relatively little known in the United States, at least. So that's enough for opening remarks, I hope. But if you have any questions, or Mark, if you have any, please ask.
Yeah, so I think we've got to think about, why did you need an Israel in the first place? And you needed an Israel because Jews were massacred en masse in Europe, that 6 million Jews were annihilated, that they weren't safe in many places around the world, and that there had been this longing to have a state where they could be safe. Now, there are many peoples who have states of their own. There are Arab states all around Israel. You mentioned Egypt. Of course, there's Iran, Iraq, Jordan, a huge mass of land of places that are Muslim states. By the way, many Jews used to live in these Muslim states. So you had 700,000 Jews who lived in North Africa, who lived in Iraq, who had, you know, been there for centuries, who were driven out. And many of those places are completely and utterly free of Jews now. There are no Jews that live in those places because they are not welcome there, as many Christians are not welcome there. Now, Israel, when it founds itself, does not found itself as a Jewish supremacist country. It recognizes that there are people with multiple faiths in the land, and it says, we will be a nation where everyone will be free to practice their religion. And then they announce their independence. And what happens when they announce their independence? Well, the surrounding Arab states decide that they should be annihilated. And so you have the War of Independence, hundreds of thousands of Jews, some of whom, you know, had just survived the Holocaust in Europe, are killed. But ultimately, they managed to vanquish their enemies. There are further attempts to annihilate Israel. So in 67, there are efforts to destroy it from, I think it's five or six states. The Israelis managed to vanquish their foes again and expand the breadth of their territory, capturing the Golan Heights and the Sinai. Ultimately, the Sinai is handed back to Egypt in a peace deal. You had in 73 the Yom Kippur War, again an attack on Jews on a sacred holiday, which is what happened on October 7th. It was Simchas Torah. There is a sense in which, as you mentioned, Spencer, the Israelis live under a perpetual state of war, that they are protected by Iron Dome, that rockets are fired daily into Israeli territory. Hundreds of thousands of Jews right now are displaced from their homes. That has nothing to do with Hamas. It has to do with Hezbollah up north. You are in a very tough neighborhood with people that want you dead. So what has been the Israeli approach on this front? It's to make peace. It's to try and do deals with their neighbors. It's to say that we have many things we can offer you that would be useful for you. So Israel is not exactly a water-rich nation, but they have worked out how to desalinate. And so they have exported that technology. That if you want to boycott Israeli products, well, you're going to find your life pretty uncomfortable because, you know, the Israelis are at the vanguard of tech development. So if you have an Intel chip inside your computer, you have Israel inside your computer. If you use Waze to drive around, that was developed by Israelis. So a lot of Arab states have recognized that it's quite a good idea if you care about prosperity to do a deal. And so while Israel was doing deals, Hamas realized that at some point they would become irrelevant, that they would be isolated. And this is probably one of the reasons why they performed the horrible acts of October 7th. I mean, also obviously motivated by a deep hatred of Jews, and specifically went out to kill, maim, torture, rape Jewish civilians. As much as there have been widespread denials of these things, unfortunately also on American campuses. So that just gives you an idea of why Israel exists and why it continues to face the threats. Now, what does that mean practically in terms of what it can do? Well, you know, if you're Liechtenstein and no one wants to invade your country, or you're Belgium, it's very easy to say things like, oh, you should be nice and, you know, why are you acting in this way and your military endeavors are too harsh? Well, because you don't face these existential threats. I mean, the Russians have just had a taste of it. And it's very interesting to see how they've responded. 140 people were gunned down by Islamic terrorists. ISIS claimed responsibility immediately. And the Russians went and captured four people, beat the living fuck out of them, I think would be the politest way of putting it. One of the guys is missing an eye and is in a wheelchair, and the other's completely covered in welts. I think one of them is missing an ear. And they're going to have a free and fair trial, I'm sure. So you get a sense of how other states respond to terrorism when it occurs, not very politely. You know, the Israelis have made it quite clear that they have two objectives, which is to eradicate Hamas, who, by the way, have pledged to perform on October 7th time and time again, and then to go and bring back home the hostages that have been you know, kept in Gaza since October 7th, that there are over 100 people there, you know, and the view in Israel is that when you walk around, you see them reflected in people's eyes, that Jews around the world feel that those hostages are us, and that it's very important to go and rescue them.
Thank you, Mark, for that. Craig, I want to turn it over to you and ask you to elaborate on your position. You said you're okay with the existence of Israel. There are a number of different points, like people who are critical of Israel have drawn lines. Some people are against the idea of any kind of nationalistic state, meaning a state for one people. So that would naturally exclude Zionism from the get-go. Others think that the beginning of the refugee problem in 1948 was Israel's sort of original sin, but that was ethnic cleansing. And others have said that things really started to go wrong in the Six-Day War with the capture of the West Bank and not giving that back or trading it off quickly enough for more for land for peace. So I'm curious, like, at what point do you think – is there a point where you think things seriously got wrong? Are you okay with the idea of Zionism? Yeah, go ahead and elaborate.
Sure. And maybe here's where it gets painful. I've been relying on a number of sources, and I think they largely agree in what they say happened. And surprisingly, one of them is the Palestinian intellectual Edward Said, who died not too long ago. And a couple of the revisionist Israeli historians, or the new historians, one is Benny Morris, and he wrote Righteous Victims, A History of the Zionist-Arab Conflict, 1881 to 2001. And the book I have is The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem Revisited. I haven't mastered those books, but I've read some of them. Ilan Pape has a book called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which is a pretty provocative title. It's difficult to go through some of the history, but I think Benny Morris, who I think is the sort of more reflexively pro-Israel of the two new historians between him and Pape, ends up saying at a certain point, well, there was an inherent problem, a sort of built-in problem of Zionism, which was there were already people settled on the land. They were cultivating cultivable land. They lived in towns. They lived in villages. They were scattered through the land. And they had a very rather compelling claim to be able to live on the land. They had lived there a long, long time. Their ancestors had been there easily 1,000 years without trying to trace bloodlines. There's no particular reason to say any group of them had. There were small groups that moved in recently, but some population figures help. 1882, and I'm using figures from either Israeli historians or actually a Jewish virtual library. But 1882, the estimates for the Jewish population of Israel, at the large version of Israel, are 5 to 8%. 1918, 8%. 1931, 17%. 1946, 30%. 1947, 32%. So this presented a problem, because if Israel were to get the whole of the land, they'd be a minority. They would have been a minority in it at the moment of independence from the British, because this all takes place in the context of the Mandate. The British took over this land from the Ottoman Empire and had this in trust from the League of Nations to raise them up toward eventual independence, which they seemed to have an obligation to make it a Arab state in accordance with the majority of the people. Of course, the British under Lord Balfour decided that it would be a good place for a home for the Jews, and he was responding to requests from early Zionists. Morris makes a very moving case that touches me. And he, long before the Holocaust, you have pogroms, you have discrimination, you have a feeling of being treated for 1,000 years easily as second-class citizens, expulsions. You know, there's a long, long list of Jewish grievances in Europe that are very real. And I think it's Morris who points out that for Herzl, who's one of the founders of Zionism, maybe the founder, the Dreyfus affair in France in 1895 is a giant shock. Here's the country of the French Revolution and egalitarianism and secularism, and they're framing a Jewish officer because it's convenient, and people feel free to express this prejudice. So all this is very moving, and by the time you get to the establishment of the state in 1947, obviously you have the immense tragedy of the Holocaust. There's a strange confluence of things where the Arabs quite naturally didn't like the idea of being displaced in this territory, which they saw as a territory. A lot of people point out that the more they realized that the Zionists had it in mind as a Jewish territory, the more they felt themselves to be Palestinian Arabs, and that's a natural reaction. All of the different authors that I've mentioned in the last few minutes talk about the fact that the early Zionists, in many cases, spoke of transfer. They wanted large numbers of the Arabs moved out. And they were rather quiet about it. Herzl put it in his diary when Ben-Gurion and some of the other leaders of the movement, the Yishuv, in Mandate Palestine, were talking about it. They didn't put it in the published minutes of their meetings and so forth. But Benny Morris says, in July 1937, there was a virtual consensus among the leaders of the Jewish community that we needed a transfer of at least several hundred thousand of the Arabs out. Benny Morris says it was not a plan, but it was a strong feeling that was widely shared among the Zionist leaders. And he's got documentary evidence for that. Edward Said has some documentary evidence for that. So, and there's a quote from Ben-Gurion in 1937 where he says, I'm in favor of compulsory transfer, and I don't have any moral, I don't see a moral problem with it. You get the partition vote in late November of 1947, and Morris's comment, among all the joy, there's one of the senior figures of the Zionist movement who says, with roughly 500,000 Jews, he was rather saddened to have 400,000 Arabs in the planned Jewish state. That didn't look workable. Didn't look good. The story seems to be that that more or less riots broke out on the Arab side, and not gentle riots. I mean, there was some killing, but Morris documents plenty of actions on both sides, and the Haganah, and then even more the Irgun and the Stern Gang responded harshly, took reprisals. Often they were kind of collective reprisals, you know, attack the village where the people came from who ambushed the car or something like this. So we had a nasty situation, and the kind of most serious moral issue, and I'm trying to rush, is that by early March of 1948, and this is before the Declaration of Independence, the Jewish leadership has a thing called Plan D. And Plan D gives brigade commanders the option of cleansing or destroying a village if it was hostile or potentially hostile. And of course, granted the fears, I mean, with hindsight, the Jewish forces were united, better armed, better trained. We knew they were literate versus a lot of the Palestinian villagers were illiterate. The Arab armies were disunited, but at the time that wasn't all crystal clear, and so there were real fears, no doubt. But in late March into early April and into May, there were there were some Jewish massacres of Palestinian villagers, not just the famous Deir Yassin, but others. There were some harsh takeovers of Arab neighborhoods in the cities where they were shared, where there was a Jewish side and an Arab side. And very rough takeovers of some villages. And it became clear to the Palestinians that they were going to lose. They were not united. The villages were not tied together. They faced a united enemy. Haganah forces come toward you, and you realize we're going to lose. We may be shot. Maybe it's a massacre, which maybe was an exaggerated fear, but not a completely irrational one. And the sum of this over the entire War of the Independence, which by mid-May, when the Israelis declare independence, they've got contiguous lines of communication. They've cleared out a lot of villages. A lot of Palestinians have run, presumably for their lives. You've got a much more Jewish state and a lot of people who've run away. And there's some expansion of that over between May and spring of 1949, May of 48 and spring of 1949. Many of these people don't run very far. Some run to Lebanon. Some get across the Jordan River, and they're in Transjordan. A lot are in the West Bank, which is the one Arab army that did well was the Arab Legion for Jordan, which, you know, occupied the West Bank and fought fairly effectively to prevent Israeli expansion in that direction. So a lot of them went to the West Bank, and a lot went to Gaza. That's a big part of the story. And the story is one of, in the heat of war, deliberately chasing people out or sowing fear when you were militarily superior and then preventing a return. This is agreed to by these, Israeli historians who have access to archives and all kinds of records of Haganah and Israeli Defense Forces before they were officially Israeli Defense Forces and so forth. So to me, that's an important part of why there are a lot of refugees in the West Bank and Gaza. It's not surprising that there was a feeling of anti-Semitism, which the Arab world, the Ottoman Empire was fairly anti-Semitic. Not so much in the very early days, but in later days it was, there's no doubt. But these people had real grievances. And I do think that when you got to 67 and that very swift conquest of the Arabs and the taking over of this, I don't know what the numbers were then, but very significant numbers of other Palestinians, there's a guy that we might think of as kind of a left-wing peacenik Israeli, but Miko Peled is the guy's name. He's written a book called The General's Son, and his father was a young officer in the War of Independence and a general in 67, and he said, "This is our chance to make peace with the Palestinians." You know, we fought. They ran. Lots of them were under Egypt and Gaza or under Jordan in the West Bank. Now we're directly responsible. We need to make peace with them. We need to figure out, show them that we want to live in peace and dignity with them. Benny Morris says, that's not what happened. He says, that's the Israeli story, but it was a military occupation with the typical accoutrements of military operation. There were beatings. He says there was torture. There was humiliation. There was collective punishment of towns if they demonstrated. These are two very painstakingly researched, thick books with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of footnotes. And I mean, I take him as a defender of Israel as much as possible, but on that front, he has a lot negative to say. And this martial law just continues for year after year. It's filled with, for lots of people on the West Bank and Gaza, daily humiliations, daily insults. There's a book, and I'm Our Harsh Logic, I think it's called. But there were some earlier books by a group that called itself Breaking the Silence, and they gathered testimony of people who served in the Israeli forces in the West Bank and to some extent Gaza, mostly the West Bank. And they paint a picture that's deeply unpleasant of being a Palestinian in those territories. Not necessarily because you did anything in particular that's awful. All right, this is a really long history, and so I'm giving you a feeling for what I think. I think, to me, the biggest missed opportunity is the 1990s, because Yasser Arafat says, "I and the PLO acknowledge the right of Israel to exist in peace and security." He accepts resolution 242 and 338. And Benny Morris points out, right near the end of his book, like, well, this was an acceptance of 22% of the original territory that they thought was rightly theirs, 22%. But they wanted that 22%. But during the 90s, Israeli politics was turbulent. Rabin was assassinated. Netanyahu seemed to not impress a lot of people, didn't want to follow the accords as they'd been laid down. He's replaced by Ehud Barak. Ariel Sharon goes to the Temple Mount with 50 policemen armed around him and goes to on a Thursday afternoon, which is right before Friday prayers. Seems like a given his reputation among the Palestinians, a guarantee of a riot at that point. But in one sense, one of the shameful moments of American diplomatic history is what I take as Bill Clinton's attempt to get his Nobel Peace Prize in the last moment. The 90s had not been going well for this peace process. Confidence building measures were, one step forward and one step back. Settlement activity had continued, new settlements or else expansion of existing settlements. There were times when Benny Morris feels like, well, and I think other historians, Yasser Arafat didn't clamp down on the terrorists in his midst at times. And at other times he did. And at other times he made concessions and really seemed to be pushing for a peace of the brave, I think he called it. And at the very end of Clinton's term, to try to ram down his throat kind of a hastily mashed together thing, and then to blame him for the breakdown of the talks, which Clinton and Barack both did after the talks broke down, when, according to the logic of these peace talks, you have to do confidence building. And all of a sudden, we're going to deal with Jerusalem, the right of return, which I think something that gave some sense of dignity, sense of we understand your loss to the Palestinians, rather than a full right of all the Palestinians to return anywhere in Israel. There was at least a potential to manage that. But the way it was done was this: here's this all or nothing deal. You're going to get, 85% of the 22% of the land. You're going to waive the right of return. We've got Jerusalem. It was a kind of a disgraceful attempt to blame Arafat for not making concessions when, in fact, the ground was not ripe. So that's kind of a simplified and very short, and I hope not too simplistic, story of missed opportunities or things that I think Israelis have to bear in mind when they look at the Palestinians who are in Gaza, who've now been under military rule for decades, and then they were under kind of a blockade for several decades now. So
okay, thank you. Mark, do you have any particular point you wanted to discuss?
I imagine that dealing with Israeli border guards as a Palestinian is very unpleasant. It's very unpleasant to have this gigantic security barrier through Jerusalem. And people look at that security barrier now and they go, you know, this is, it's a blight on the landscape. It's very ugly. It's terrible to push through it. And as I imagine, as an outsider, if you walked in there, you'd say, oh, we should tear this wall down, Mr. Gorbachev. Unless you go into cafes in Jerusalem or ride buses, and they tell you, you see that piece of shrapnel that's in the wall? Well, that's where a suicide bomber blew himself up and killed a whole bunch of people. That bus that you're riding, yeah, people got blown up on those buses. And once you put up the security barrier, that stopped happening. I think people have a very short memory. And, you know, you mentioned, Craig, the acts of terrorism performed under Arafat's rule. I mean, imagine living in a society where you just don't know if you're going to be murdered in the most brutal, awful ways, that you could be on public transport, having a coffee in a restaurant, and some person might kill you with a suicide vest. You know, in America, you're used to the idea of an armed gunman who comes in, but the idea of someone who looks like a pregnant woman, you know, who's actually carrying a, you know, an explosive vest, that's a pretty horrifying prospect. So the Israelis have had to take certain measures. Now, what's interesting is you mentioned about those living in Gaza living under a blockade. Well, what you had was Jews living in Gaza, and in 2005, they were forcibly taken from their homes. And they didn't want to leave, and the Israeli government said, we're taking you out. And whatever infrastructure you have, it's now the Palestinians. And the Palestinians, instead of, you know, using those homes or those gardens that were built or the schools or whatever they were, they destroyed them. And then they built a terror state where they fired rockets from Gaza into Israel. Now, I know of no other country on the planet that has to have a system like Iron Dome. The idea that you have to spend an enormous amount of money, and the Americans, by the way, don't have tech like this, where you send a rocket that within seconds has to hit another rocket that is coming at you and triangulate whether it's a good idea to send this rocket. Maybe this rocket's going to hit a field. Maybe it's going to hit a hospital. Maybe it's going to hit a school. Imagine living under that. Day in and day out, you've got, you know, kids who within 30 seconds, the, you know, bomb sign's gone off, time to go into the shelter. Like, that is a pretty awful way to live. Now, the Palestinians in Gaza receive billions of dollars from around the world. And you're on the Mediterranean. You could build a little Singapore. You could be the most incredible destination to go and see. You know, you could be Doha. You could be, you know, one of these wonderful spots. And people love Palestinians. Did they do that? No. They built a bunch of terror tunnels so they could go and kidnap Israelis and smuggle in arms. So, as you say, when we're thinking about squandering your opportunities, that is an absolute tragedy. I mean, I'm all in favor of freeing Palestine from Hamas. I mean, you have this murderous death cult that kills its opponents in 2007, murders people from Fatah, throws them off buildings, steals all the money. I mean, the leaders of Hamas live in Qatar and they're billionaires. You know, it's a wonderful job to have while people live in squalor. It's a real, real tragedy. And none of that falls at the hands of Israel. You know, the Israelis would basically say, we de facto gave you a state. In 2005, you got self-rule. And if you weren't bombing us, you know, we could have traded with you. The Israelis, of course, were letting in Palestinians from Gaza who were working on farms and being taken to hospitals. And those Palestinians went and betrayed their Israeli brothers by producing maps so that when Hamas broke over in October 7th, they knew who to kill and who to rape and who houses to burn down. So, you know, the idea that, you know, you can have peace with these neighbors is sort of a laughable prospect. By the way, the old canard that's been banged around for I don't know how long is this idea of a two-state solution. And at least since 2005, that's been a really fucking stupid idea because Gaza is, this is what Israel looks like. It's a tiny country. It's the size of New Jersey. So Gaza's over there. Okay, the West Bank's over here. They're run by different governments who hate each other. As I mentioned, Hamas went and killed the Fatah guys. This idea that we should have a two-state solution that was repeated ad nauseum all the time doesn't take into account well, you've got two different governments in two different parts of the place, and they don't like each other very much. How are these two states going to suddenly merge? Not very obvious. It's now not clear how desirable it would be to have, what, a fully functioning state of Gaza if it's still filled with homicidal maniacs. The idea that, you know, the Israelis shouldn't have any kind of military oversight over a body like that is just completely and utterly naive. One of the other questions, as I mentioned earlier, hundreds of thousands of Jews who lived in Arab states were pushed out from their homes. No one cares. There's no talk of a right to return. There's no sense that these people, you know, should be placed back in their ancestral homes in Algeria and Morocco and Iraq and Iran. The view is enough time has passed. You have been absorbed into another country. Now, Spencer knows very well about Germans who were forcibly removed from places after World War II. That's when the India was formed, you had Muslims who were forcibly displaced. These things are all terrible, but they happened a very long time ago. And one must ask, given the prosperity of all the Arab states around, why have they not absorbed those citizens? Why have they allowed a festering wound of the refugee crisis to persist since 1947? Well, because it suits them. It suits them to have this difficult situation for the Israelis, that the Israelis have to confront moral problems that no one else in the world has to confront, that they can take whatever measures they like to protect civilian life, and they will never be good enough. That they can warn people before they drop bombs. They can set out flyers. They can compromise their military strategy. You know, they can do things that no other nation on earth would dare dream of doing, and it will never be enough because it suits the surrounding states to have this crisis, this perpetual crisis, and that is all rather tragic. I think when you're trying to solve some of the moral problems, you're dealing with, you know, non-ideal facts, that you've got such a lack of trust over time, that you've had these terrible crimes, you know, committed by the Palestinians against the Israelis, that you've had this harsh treatment of the Palestinians by the Israelis. As I mentioned, going through those border controls or working in Israel, all that stuff is quite difficult. Of course, within Israel, there are many Arab Israelis who are loyal to Israel, aren't treated like second-class citizens, you know, can be elected to be members of parliament in the Knesset, can be Supreme Court judges, you know, can lead flourishing lives, can practice their faith. As I say, you're dealing with a rich society. Zionism is not a Jews-only place. You know, the idea is that it's a Jewish state with Jewish values, but it has space for others in a way that its neighboring states are not that. Sharia law operates there. One of the things that I find rather bizarre is how those on the left have decided that the Palestinian cause is the one worth supporting. The idea of, like, gays for Gaza. And I think, try and say that in Gaza. How would you be treated by Hamas? You know, you think they would embrace you and say, thank you so much, my LGBTI allies. You know, we really appreciate your support. No, they'd fucking behead you. They think you're doing a really terrible thing and that you don't deserve to live. Hamas scorn the West. And it is shocking to me that American campuses seem to think that they're rooting for the good guys. The levels of ignorance are rather shocking. If you go and ask people who are singing From the River to the Sea, which river and which sea, they can't tell you because they are useful idiots.
I should intervene first a little bit and just say we are stuck to some extent with dueling histories because I would contest some of those not only the statements, but somewhat the emphasis. And I don't think, just to give one example, I don't think the Gaza Strip was set free to control its own destiny after the 2005 exit to make whatever choices it wanted. I know they could have made different choices than the ones they made, but I think they were extremely restrained. I'll say that whether leftists on college campuses are have good sense of what they're going to emphasize or not is in some ways not my issue because I'm not a leftist, even if I were on a college campus. So, I mean, but and in the overall scheme of things, you know, what are the great issues that people ought to be worried about? That's certainly debatable. So,
yeah, there is some dueling history here. I want to ask each of you what you think the normative significance of that history is. So to start with, like, the, or I guess to focus on the Independence War, it seems to me that it's got to be true that there's some blame on each side, and we're arguing about proportions. The Darius thing definitely happened. The Arab armies definitely attacked Israel. It's about who gets what percentage of the blame, I think. I think that's true. And my question, I guess, is, does that matter, practically speaking? Like, suppose we take the view that Israel is mostly responsible for the Palestinian refugee problem. It's not my view, but let's just say that's the case. How would that matter, practically speaking, to how Israel operates, how they're engaging in the current war? Would it matter at all? My view is that I was careful to emphasize in my opening statement that I have sort of a more forward-looking view. I sort of take Israel's side because I expect that they're more likely to realize my values on the whole than whatever would be likely to replace them. So I think I could say, suppose, Craig, your side is right about the history. I think what that would mean would be Israel, after they achieve peace and security, it would determine how much reparations they would have to pay to the Palestinians. But before that, but while they're still being threatened, I'm not sure I see it having a whole lot of normative relevance. Like, it would be insane for the United States to try to do slave reparations while World War II was going on, for example. So I'm wondering what normative significance you place on those events that you described.
Well, I think there is some normative significance, but there's the other point I would make is that that Israel established itself pretty quickly as a dominant military power and fully capable of repelling combined attacks from its neighbors. So, I mean, Israel in 1956 went with France and seized the Suez Canal, if I recall. That's a confident country with confident military leaders that knows what it can do. So I don't think there's a picture of Israel still being under endless existential threat from the neighbors. Which, by the way, just a point of detail, like, Sharia law is not operative in Egypt or Jordan or Syria or Lebanon, so that's a bit of an exaggeration. But gays would be better received in Israel than in any of those countries, no doubt, especially if they wanted to assert their rights. No question. I think for me, the picture I see is one of ongoing domination that followed the War of Independence, so that there was no significant movement in Israeli society. It certainly was not a suggestion of the government, let's make the West Bank independent, or let's make Jerusalem an international city because we have to have, you know, we assert our total right to it, but we're willing to have a commission. You know, we want to have the Muslim states involved, but we're letting the West Bank be free, or giving it back to Jordan if they're willing to have peace with us. There was no such movement, and there wasn't any such movement in Gaza, as I understand it. And so I don't think we have a picture of Israel remaining under existential threat and just waiting to finally be secure. And I think it sounds harsh to say it, but I think there's a bit of an excuse, because Israel has had overwhelming power for a long, long time. Yes, I mean, the suicide bombings have been terrible. The problem seems to be that you have an ongoing conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, treated as a conflict on both sides, not that the Israelis have said, now you're free, do what you like. And the, you know, Palestinians stubbornly insisted on attacking Israel. So I guess I'm questioning the premise of your question to some extent and saying they haven't been left independent to figure out what they want to do and then have chosen to attack Israel.
I guess I don't agree, but rather than contest that, I'm going to ask Mark. suppose the at least about the 48 war, the Palestinian narrative is correct, the pro-Palestinian narrative is correct, and the lion's share of the blame for this belongs with Israel. What is the normative significance of that now, do you think?
Yes, well, as you mentioned, it doesn't seem like it would give the Palestinians living in Gaza any kind of license to engage in the conduct that they've engaged in. Their aim is the eradication of Israel. It's to kill every Jew that's there. You're not sort of saying, you know, we're just fighting for our personal freedom and we have no choice because, you know, 75 years ago, our ancestors were, you know, pushed out of their homes in this war. As I mentioned, they could easily have been absorbed into other states and they weren't. They could have built up their own state in Gaza with the enormous amounts of money they get. And they built a terror state. So it doesn't strike me that even if the facts are the, let's say, the Nakba facts, that that would give you the license to go and do what they do. That it's quite unique. I mean, what other kinds of situations do we find around the world where you have a populace that's that hostile, that's deliberately trying to kill civilians? I mean, one way to think about the difference in moral attitude is that Hamas will use human shields to protect soldiers. They'll hide in schools and in hospitals. That it suits them whenever a child dies because it helps on the PR. What would happen if the Israelis used human shields? Well, would it deter Hamas? No, of course not. It would just be more people to kill. That's the difference, that the Israelis value life and the Hamas don't. You know, Hamas think that they'll use the idea of a life lover and an abusive term, that the Jews love life and we love death because we realize that there's an afterlife and, you know, that is what matters more. That the incentive structure there is rather poisonous. That it's very hard to negotiate with someone who just doesn't have the ordinary kinds of interests that people have. So that makes things tough.
I don't want to exactly contest that. I mean, I think part of the background, I'm not a fan in the very least of Hamas. So I want to make that clear. I do think they were elected and won a solid majority in the Palestinian elections of, I think it was 2006. Yeah. Palestinian National Authority. And I think, I hate to say this, but I think they did it in part because Arafat's government was corrupt and not very effective. But I also think in part because Arafat's government kept saying, we have to make peace with Israel and we're going to get these benefits. We're going to get peace with honor and we're going to achieve some of our dreams. And yet, no matter how long Arafat negotiated, it seemed like the offer was never something that the Palestinians felt was dignified. So I think that's why I say the 90s, I think, really was a wasted opportunity or a missed opportunity, and that I think Hamas would not have been elected if the PLO had managed to achieve something working with Israel. I want to add just one piece of evidence, and I'm sorry, it's less philosophical. there was an exit poll of Palestinian voters. This is a Wikipedia article, so who knows? But they said support for a peace agreement with Israel, 79.5% in support, 15.5% opposed. Should Hamas change its policies regarding Israel? Yes, 75.2%. No, 24.8%. Under Hamas, corruption will decrease. Yes, 78%. Under Hamas, internal security will improve. Yes, 67.8%. Yeah, I think the Palestinians in throughout the occupied territories, I think they wanted a peace deal, and they were sick of all the negotiations of the 90s, which seemed to be going nowhere. The Israelis had changed horses 3 or 4 times during that time, and they were like, well, we're stuck with this one guy. Let's try a change. I could see that as a tragic mistake. I agree that Hamas is a lousy government that commits all kinds of crimes. I'm not sure that that the Israeli approach is going to lead to the people voting on somebody better. I do know Israel tries to discriminate in war, but I would like to see an approach that seems to reach out to the Palestinians and be willing to make some concrete steps that would touch them. So, and maybe that sounds naive, but that's how I see it.
Craig, so my understanding is you have to go pretty soon.
That's true. That's right.
How about, there's one question I definitely have to get your view on, and then I could finish up with Mark, if that would be okay with you.
Okay, that works.
I want to ask you about proportionality and your view on proportionality in this current war that's going on in Gaza. So you had the terrible October 7th attacks of last year, and Israel has responded, invading Gaza, trying to get rid of Hamas. And it's frequently being pointed out that far more Palestinians have died than Israelis were killed in the attacks that initiated this round of conflict. And some are claiming, I mean, lots of things are being claimed, but one of the claims that I think is credible and worth looking into is this, well, this is a disproportionate reaction. And I'm not sure I buy that. I see why people say it, but I don't know exactly how we should understand proportionality in war. It can't be the view that, well, they've killed X many of your citizens, so whatever defensive maneuvers you have to take to stop the aggressing force, you have to stop right when you've killed as many people as they had killed in their attack. That seems insane. But I also admit that it's difficult to cash out this notion of proportionality in a way that seems reasonable in a wide range of cases. And I know you've done a lot of research on this topic of just war ethics. So I want to hear your take.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I do think it's quite difficult. One of the books that critiqued my first book said, proportionality can't be this mathematical calculation. And I thought, well, true, but everybody who talks about proportionality tries to weigh sort of human cost, basically, against human cost of what would happen the other way. And I agree with you. You can't say, oh, we have to stop when we've got the same number. That's absurd. I do think that one of the issues for proportionality in a given battle, you can say, well, we have this very important strategically important objective, or even tactically important. We have to get rid of this factory. We have to blow up this bridge. We have to take this location. And yet there are civilians. There are children. If it's vitally important and it isn't 100,000 civilians surrounding that, they're all going to die, sure. You may well be justified. And it's, I, it's one of those things where it's not a hard and fast rule. There's no particular rule. I'm very troubled by reports of extreme hunger. And I feel like, if the population of the place is being starved, I don't know if Israel is even negligent in not trying to allow food to get through. I think that is one of the most severe proportionality issues that, that may be coming up, that may be happening right now. But even the numbers of civilians are distressing, I think, to anybody. And the one thing that's gone around in my mind as I've thought about this issue is that an issue that's not very often raised is proportionality, I think, has to be seen in light of the overall aim. Like, and I think that a militarily superior force, it may need to punish the leaders, as we insisted after World War II in Japan or in Germany as well. But it also has to offer, it has to offer something. And this would be kind of my challenge to Mark. Like, I think you eliminated various options. And then what I jotted in my notes was, okay, what do we do here? I don't think we should think of the Palestinians as bloodthirsty people who, I mean, obviously they can be in the heat of the moment. But I think the overall aim of some kind of dignified peace is really necessary for a convincing case of proportionality to be offered. That's pretty incomplete and fuzzy, but I think I need to leave. I've enjoyed the talk, sorry I have to go early.
Well, thanks so much, Craig. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. So I guess it is my duty now to step in and push the pro-Palestinian side just to have some balance in the conversation, because it just wouldn't be the same if we were all agreeing. So I have to say, I am worried about this war, and I have the thought that, looking back on this several years, are we going to think that this invasion of Gaza is a good idea? It seems, just generally speaking, we can make a pessimistic induction about wars generally. How many of them turn out to be good and wise in the grand scheme of things? Even if you look at Ronan Bergman's book on targeted killings, even when Israel is targeting really nasty, nasty people who probably deserve to die, very often that backfires. Very often you end up with something worse. You end up killing more civilians than you anticipated. You precipitate international crisis, or you hurt your country's reputation in some way. And so if a killing of one person or a few people can go wrong in that way, there are a lot of ways wars can go wrong. And so I'm nervous about this. I'm wondering if things might have been, maybe the smarter move might have been to secure the border, try to get this deal done with the Saudis. What do you think?
Absolutely not. I think that if we're looking at just wars, this is one of the most just wars, that you are dealing with a genocidal terrorist group who have called for your annihilation, who have tried to kill as many civilians as they could, who've done the most brutal, barbarous, terrible things, videoed themselves doing it. This is not a time to turn the other cheek. This was a time to kill every single member of Hamas and to rescue every single hostage. Now, if we talk about proportionality, as you say, there is the dimwits version of it, which is that you count the numbers on either side and you sort of see it in the reporting where it says 1,200 Israelis lost their lives and 30,000 Palestinians have lost their lives. It's disproportionate. Well, that's to completely and utterly misunderstand how the principle of proportionality works. What you are meant to do is discriminate between civilians and hostiles. So you're not meant to deliberately target civilians. So first of all, we know Hamas breaches that by deliberately targeting civilians. Then if you are engaged in conduct where you say, look, there is a military aim that's legitimate and there will be collateral damage in the form of civilians, then you have to ask, well, is the benefit of that military aim proportional to the damage? And you have to ask that on a strike-by-strike basis. And you also, of course, have to take into account the deterrence effect. So, as I mentioned, hundreds of thousands of Israelis have been driven from their homes in the north. If you just turn the other cheek, it's not just Hamas that are going to come in and try and kill you again. It's Hezbollah. It's Iran. There's a reason why Israel is a serious military force in the region. It's because it continues to face threats from its neighbors, that if it wasn't a strong military force, that if it was a bunch of peaceniks, they'd all be dead. The difficulty, of course, is to work out what's the day after. But I don't recall the Allies being asked in 1942, you know, what are you going to do after you kill all the Nazis? You know, what's your plan? What's going on here, guys? Please tell us. We're 5 months into a war, and the amount of global pressure on the Israelis after facing, as I say, the biggest anti-Semitic incident since the Holocaust is just astounding. The fact that people are desperately worried about the Palestinians when they don't give a fuck about the Palestinians who were murdered in Syria in much greater numbers, about the ongoing wars around the world, the number of people who are displaced from their homes, who are murdered in Sudan or in the Congo, no one cares. So when you look at what Israel does, it's almost like being a sports commentator, you're doing Holyfield versus Tyson or something, and you only mention the blows that Tyson lands. You'd think that this guy was an absolute brute. So he's just beating up this poor guy for no reason. This is terrible. And because you don't mention all the times that Holyfield, you know, hits him or bites his ear off or does these terrible things. So there is a sense in which the way that Israel is covered is not necessarily dishonest, and that, you know, the things that the Israelis done, often they do, but they're done in response to something, that they're disproportionately covered, that you hear very few good news stories about Israel coming out of the international press. I think I read a piece that there are 40 different news agencies that run out of Jerusalem, whereas the number that I think cover the whole continent of Africa doesn't number that. That seems strange that we should care about a place the size of New Jersey with that, but not care so much about, you know, the biggest growing continent on the planet, and that most people, you know, think Africa is a country. So yeah, that sort of thing worries me. I think that the Israelis have to achieve total victory, that it's really unfortunate that there is growing pressure on them to cease the war. I think all calls for a ceasefire at the moment are totally and utterly immoral. As I say, that the threat needs to be eliminated. What you do afterwards, of course, is a complicated thing. And Israel needs to ensure that it's safe. Its primary duty is to its citizens. It needs to ensure that you have some kind of denazification project in Gaza. It's nice to hear that at some point in time, average Gazans were in favor of a peace deal. But I gather right now, many in the West Bank would vote in Hamas if they could. So you're not dealing with the most stable of geniuses in terms of a population, who've been fed on nothing but hate, you know, who live in squalor partly because of Hamas. So you've got to work out how to deal with that on an ongoing basis. And of course, we don't see any of the Arab states offering help on this front, saying, well, let us help rebuild. Let us be part of the Marshall Plan. We're not seeing that sort of support at all.
This reminds me of another one of my favorite conversations about this issue in Egypt, where there was an Egyptian guy who was complaining about how Gaza was a prison and the Palestinians were stuck there. And I said, you know, you've got a border with them in Rafah. You could open the border. And he's like, no, 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 no. Gaza people are not angels. No, 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 no. He was like immediately like, oh my God, I don't want those people next to me. And it's like, oh, but Israel has to take them all. That's great. That's really ballast of you. It was a pretty amazing cell phone how quickly he was like, oh my God, no. I thought that was amusing. You know, here's a comparison I haven't seen, but Sri Lanka had this civil war with the Tamil Tigers that lasted for decades. And I think it was like 2008, 2009, they got a new leader who's like, we are ending this. We are ending this. And there was a big military buildup, and the Tamil Tigers are no more. And it killed, I looked at the Wikipedia figures. I'm like, huh, how many people died in that 2008, 2009? It was like 30, 40,000 civilians. I don't remember being subjected to this, you know, pornography of suffering 24/7 in the news cycle. I don't remember a single college student giving a damn about it. And you and I could multiply these examples. On the other hand, one big difference is, I think with Sri Lanka, there wasn't this issue of how do you govern it? How do you govern it once the war with the Tamil Tigers is over? You have the Sri Lankan government. With Gaza, it's going to be a literal military occupation. The occupation they've been pretending that they've had this whole time, they're actually going to get it. And I don't know that this is good for Israel. I mean, I don't see this going well for Israel. They're going to have lots and lots of soldiers who are going to be killed in guerrilla attacks and stuff like that. And I mean, there's a reason they pulled out of there in 2005. And so you can say, okay, it's not disproportionate because the end is good, the end of wiping out Hamas. But I think the proportionality also has to include like a probability function for success. And I'm not sure that I see a happy ending to this, even when Hamas is gone. And believe me, I don't think you can outdo me in hate for Hamas. I despise them. Totally do. But I still worry that the effort of going in and getting rid of them is going to lead to other bad things.
Yeah, I think that is the difficulty. Golda Meir said, you know, we would have peace if the Arabs love their sons as much as they hate us. This is the difficulty, that you've got this asymmetric battle, that you've got people who are willing to die for a pernicious cause. The Israelis don't want to be involved in military occupation there. It would really, really suit them if the independent Republic of Gaza was a flourishing place. That was, you know, opulent, and people lived good lives by the beach. You know, they set up whatever kinds of businesses that some of their Arab neighbors have done. That would be great. It's a huge drain on the Israeli economy to have, first of all, people who work ordinary jobs having to work as reservists put their lives on the line, and the amount of money that you spend on the military. But they don't have a choice. So I agree, it's not good for Israel. But that's not the Israelis' fault. That's, of course, at Hamas's feet. And it is a human tragedy that's unfolding. By the way, on the famine front, I think it's something that I've been hearing for many months. The South Africans, when they went to the ICJ in 26th of January, said, well, we're on the verge of a mass starvation. And we're hearing it now on their third attempt to go to the ICJ. I think not a single person has died of malnutrition yet. So, you know, you probably will have people fighting over grain. And of course, the Israelis are still ensuring that humanitarian aid goes through. It's unfortunate that they're in a position where you have to go and check the aid trucks because you don't want weapons coming across. But it's not the case that you're dealing with a population that is, you know, deliberately being starved to death. Given that the war has gone on, you know, since October 7th, we would have expected everybody to have died by now of starvation. And of course, they haven't. So many of the claims that are made that are critical of Israel just don't seem to be borne out by the facts.
I feel like there's dialectically something weird about this here, which is I don't want to say, whatever their conduct is like in this war, they're better than Hamas. I mean, of course, that's too low of a bar. I want to be open-minded about criticizing them in Joseph Bello grounds. On the other hand, there's something weird about, I feel like every time I hear someone criticizing Israel for not doing enough to prevent civilian casualties, there's like two levels of the discourse. On one level, there's just, is that true or is that not? But then there's another level, which I think that's precisely what Hamas wants you to think and how they've set it up. And they've made it so that an imperfect country will, of course, do wrong things, as happens in war. And so I find myself having a knee-jerk reaction against some of these sorts of criticisms, and then reflecting on that, like, well, what really should my reaction be here? Am I being complacent by not criticizing Israel for killing so many civilians? Is that showing a lack of sympathy for the Palestinians? Should I think of it as like, okay, whatever mistakes they've made, whatever, that's a Hamas propaganda trap, so I shouldn't affirm or repeat that? You see what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think you're right to say that you shouldn't judge Israel by the standards of Hamas. That is, you know, to put too low a bar. What you should probably do is compare it to the actions of other states who are engaged in urban warfare. And one way to think about proportionality in civilians is to look at ratios. So it's quite hard to work out the exact numbers, but the Israelis at one point guesstimated that it was about 2 civilians to every combatant who was killed. So I think during the ICJ case, there were about 26,000 people in total who were killed, and about, I think, 8,000 to 10,000 of those were militants. So 2 to 1 sounds quite high, but then you've got to go in comparison to what? So if you go and look at other examples of urban warfare, one that comes to mind is NATO in Yugoslavia, who were trying to prevent a genocide, and their ratio of Serbian deaths to civilians, to militants, was 4 to 1. I think that the wars in Afghanistan are about 3 to 1. So, you know, Israel is underranged on that front. Also, of course, you don't have in those other states the civilian shields problem. So, and you're dealing with militants who are, you know, wearing uniforms, who are easily identifiable as an opposing army, as opposed to, you know, people who are dressed like civilians and sort of keeping weapons caches in civilians' homes or in schools or in hospitals. So that makes it much, much harder. And as you say, there's this incentive on a PR level for Hamas to amp the numbers up. What does strike me as kind of amazing is, think about, you're a PR firm and I must go on this raping murder spree broadcasted all around the world. And your job is to make them look like the victims here. You'd think, what an impossible task. This is the worst possible client brief I could ever draw. How could anybody have sympathy for these barbarians? And quite quickly, you had people taking to the streets of London and New York, celebrating decolonization, you know, saying, this is how you push back against the Zionists. You know, this is, you know, liberation now. It's unbelievable. And not just among people who are, you know, extremists. As I mentioned, the college campus kids, people at Harvard, you know, those that you think are benighted and, you know all the right stuff, seem to have very quickly been duped. That's, I think, a deeper question. In other words, there's the denazification project to be done in Gaza, but it seems like there's got to be a de-radicalization project in other countries around the world as well. How are so many young people sympathetic to this murderous movement? I think there needs to be some deep reflection there.
I deem the genocide thing not worthy to be discussed. I think it's just completely stupid. So I'm going to skip that and go to the next thing, which is, as a South African lawyer, you should probably have something to say about the comparison between Israel and the apartheid regime. It's a comparison that's often made by Israel's critics. What would you say to that?
Pretty a great story. So there's a African National Congress guy. So this is the Party of Liberation in South Africa, came into power after apartheid, and they have a student movement on campuses. And on South African campuses, they have a thing called Israel Apartheid Week. These comparisons are made so that Israel is an apartheid state, and this kind of propaganda spreads in South Africa. And so one of these guys said, well, I'd actually kind of like to see for myself. I've been involved in Israel Apartheid Week now for a couple of years. This seems to be the party line. Maybe I should go. And so he went. And he came back and he said, I am so angry, so filled with disgust and revulsion after my trip to Israel, because I realize I've been lied to, because I know what apartheid entailed. You know, I grew up with a history of what apartheid entailed, which meant this, you know, racial segregation, really different rights for different people based on the color of their skin. And I went to Israel and I saw Arabs and Israelis in the same country with the same voting rights, with the same abilities to start businesses, to go to parliament. You're like, this is not an apartheid. To claim this is an apartheid is not only false, but it's to water down what this African experience really was. If you think about what apartheid really entailed, I mean, it went down to dramatic levels. So you were not a South African citizen if you were black. You know, your citizenship got stripped from you. You couldn't vote. You couldn't work in certain areas. You couldn't live in certain areas. You couldn't marry people of different races. You had a very entrenched, this is, in other words, if you're skeptical about systemic racism, this was systemic racism. This was putting a system in place to ensure that you had actual white supremacy, to, you know, violate people's rights on the grounds of their race. It's a really sinister system. You just don't find that in Israel. You asked me, you know, what are the books I would recommend if you're reading about Israel? I thought of something that's a little bit out of left field, which is a book called Operation Moses. So this book is about the Jews who lived in Ethiopia, who were black, and were evacuated out by the Israelis because they, you know, faced death in the Ethiopian Civil War, and faced enormous amounts of peril. Walked mainly from Ethiopia to Sudan and were then flowed out. And the idea was to first take out the children and then take out the adults. So you had hundreds and hundreds of these children accompanied by Israeli soldiers and then integrated into Israeli society. And you know, this sort of idea that one of the reasons why Israelis are so evil is that they're white. You know, and whites are the bad guys, clearly. And that's not to take into account that Israelis come in many different colors. That, as I mentioned, you had Arab Israelis from Iraq and Yemen. I'm going to a friend of mine's art exhibition on the weekend, and she's a Yemenite Israeli. You have many black Israelis. You're really dealing with a very, very multicultural population with hugely different ancestral roots. And it is a melting pot in the most interesting ways of trying to say, you know, how do we all live together, you know, despite all of our differences. You know, often outsiders to Israel, you know, imagine that Israelis are all the same and that Israelis all think the same stuff. They don't realize, of course, that all governments in Israel are coalition governments, that there's a huge amount of internal debate about, you know, what Israeli policy should be and how many people are ultra-Orthodox and, you know, all the different backgrounds they come from. It's a very diverse, rich place. So yeah, the claims of apartheid are rather libelous.
I understand where you're coming from with the rejection of the two-state solution. I'm not quite sure I'm willing to follow you there, although I see the rationale, right? The rationale is, look what happened in Gaza, right? Every square inch of land ceded is just going to be more platforms for launching rockets back at us or something. So I do see that argument, and I think it's hard to it very much complicates the question of the what to do with the settlers in the West Bank, but it seems like there are not that many possible solutions here. One of them is the two-state solution. We rule that out, which seems like, okay, if neither side wants to live with one another, it's like trying to make a marriage work when both sides want a divorce. It's like, it's not going to happen. Okay, so what are the alternatives? One side completely kills the other, or one side makes the other leave. Are there other alternatives, or are those exhaustive? Logically, you could include both sides under the same government, but that's actually even more utopian than the two-state solution. The one-state solution, allegedly, this is what people who yell from the river to the sea, really mean. Yeah, right. I believe that. We're just going to have the Eastern Mediterranean Republic, and it's going to be Palestinians and Israelis together in one peaceful government. Who would the national heroes be? What would their holidays be? It's inconceivable. Okay, so what are our options? Ethnic cleansing or this forever? Another war every 6 years forever. What's the way out of this?
Very difficult. I mean, I've said before a three-state solution was something that's worth considering and de facto what's been happening. So part of why I think the two-state solution is laughable is because the idea of a state that encompasses Gaza and the West Bank is just divorced from the territorial integrity of the place and of the hostility between the two governors of it. Maybe that changes if Hamas gets eradicated and the Palestinians get de-radicalized and you build some kind of corridor and land swaps and things. It does seem like it would be ideal, of course, if you could have a peaceful, prosperous Palestinian state that could, live alongside its Israeli neighbors. You have cold pieces with other states. So, the Egyptians and the Israelis have a cold peace, as you mentioned. The Egyptians don't really like Jews very much, and there aren't many who live there. I think it's literally, if it's 10, it's a lot. Those pieces are changing, and they were, looking much better with the Abraham Accords for a while, and maybe the sort of deal with the Saudis gets on track again. I think part of why you have those peace deals as well is that those Arab states are not so fond of the Iranians, and recognize that for their own interests, it's a good idea to do a deal with the Israelis. And I do think that interest-based solutions are the best way to deal with things. It's just very hard when people hold irrational interests. In other words, they don't value their own lives. That they are willing to sacrifice their brethren for, glory in the afterlife. That makes it quite hard to do a negotiation. Look, I think what is difficult is you think about other intractable problems. You think about the, troubles in Ireland, from 1916 to the 90s. And then they got largely resolved. You have a two-state solution that worked quite well there. So things are impossible until they're not. I think in South Africa, for example, people expected a very bloody civil war after the fall of apartheid. And, you had this kind of miraculous rainbow nation. It's not clear that that's persisting. South Africa is a difficult place. And we've got elections coming up in about 2 months. And for the first time ever, it's possible the ANC will be ousted. That may be good and also may be bad. It may lead to a lot of chaos and possibly bloodshed and maybe even secession into other states. Something that would have been thought of as a completely insane thing to have said 10 years ago now sounds much more possible. Yeah, I think we live in a much more uncertain world, and I think it's hard to say maybe there is no solution. Maybe things are just going to keep going on in this terrible way, that Israel is going to be caught in some perpetual war. Every 15 years, it's going to be fighting with the Lebanese or, fighting with the Gazans. It would be much better if they weren't. I think they wouldn't like to be doing that. But maybe a chilly peace that occasionally erupts into some hostilities is, the best they can get, unless they're... Palestinians change their minds.
It seems to me that the best solution I can think of would be to get the Palestinians citizenship in existing Arab states, like get Gazans, or at least some of them, Egyptian citizenship, get people in the West Bank Jordanian citizenship, because those are functioning states, and any kind of citizenship almost is better than none. So what would incentivize the Arab states to do that when their populations clearly would see this as the betrayal of the Palestinian cause, which they are very heated about? So I don't know.
It's amazing to me that this is such an unpopular idea, that if you really cared about the individuals who live there and you wanted them to be prosperous and to lead good lives going forward, it does seem like granting them citizenship in surrounding areas would be a great idea. And I imagine that there would be some amount of money that could be dedicated to a cause like this. As I mentioned, there were Jews who were driven out of their homes all over the world And the community said, well, we care about the prosperity of these individuals, and you know, they can come live with us, either in Israel or America or South Africa. You know, you had Jews fleeing Europe, and as I said, Jews fleeing North Africa later, and they were absorbed. And you don't have an appetite for that. In fact, you had people saying that would be the worst possible thing if the poor Palestinians were driven out of Gaza. You know, if it's, is it an open air prison, or you know, is it a wonderful homeland? I mean, if you think about the size of Gaza and compare it to the size of the Sinai, I mean, you could fit Gaza in there many, many times. And you know, the Sinai's got some pretty nice resorts in it, so that would be a viable option. There is, by the way, a Palestinian majority that lives in Jordan, run by a Hashemite minority. Many of those Palestinians haven't been treated very well by the king there. But of course, that's not worth talking about.
Right. No, the Black Tuesday, where he forced them all out into Lebanon. Until recently, I don't think this is true anymore, but until recently, that killed more Palestinians than all of the Israel-Palestine wars until I think this current conflict, it finally went up.
That's why everyone was taken to the streets at the time and just saying, yeah, like, Donald, you know, this is horrendous, and how dare you committing a genocide. And they, people went to the ICJ, actually, and they took the Jordanians to task. And, you know, the Jordanians have spent an enormous amount of time, you know, confessing their sins and writing history books about it. It's, yeah, I'm really glad that happened.
Yeah, right. You know, I was thinking there would be an interesting alternative history to write of all the Jews who were kicked out of the Arab countries. And I think Iran too. And imagining them being this homeless, stateless thing sustained by their own UN agency for many decades, being kicked around and becoming terrorists and bombing all of these places. I mean, that's just so far. It seems comical. It's like, it's hard to say that with a straight face. Imagine that happening in the other side, because as you said, Israel absorbed those people. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I guess this will be my last point. I've always been really disturbed at how the left can't quite see jihadism as the same kind of evil as Nazism. And in my view, if you see Hamas as anything better than the Nazis, you don't really understand. Netanyahu, I mean, whatever else you want to say about the guy, he was right about this. He said that the Nazis were the ideology of the master race, and Hamas is the ideology of the master faith. So they're basically similarly awful authoritarian ideologies, but just the left cannot get worked up about it. Boulder, Colorado added Nablus as a sister city. Nablus, Palestine, in the West Bank. And that place is notorious for having an actual shrine honoring a pizzeria suicide bomber, where you walk into it and it includes a display of a room where the walls are splattered with body parts and bits of pizza. Just a completely disgusting temple of Jew murder. And I think, I mean, it didn't last for very long. I think even Arafat found that embarrassing to the cause and had that removed. But imagine the very left-wing citizens of Boulder, Colorado, having as a sister city, you know, some town in apartheid South Africa, or some place that was mostly white that had a shrine to Jew murder in it somewhere. I mean, it's just, it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable. But there's this idea, I guess, that Palestinians, and I get into some extent, this has been extended to Muslims generally, that they're an oppressed category. And I guess being oppressed means never having to say you're sorry. Being oppressed means you're held to no expectations.
Yeah, on its face, sort of gays for Gaza thing just seems so insane. And you think about the particular issues that those on the left care about, and you think, well, why are you teaming up with these guys? But I suppose, as you say, you've just got this very simplistic narrative of the oppressors and the oppressed. And so if you're Muslim or black or, you know, whatever the group is, trans, then, you know, you're the oppressed. And so we're all in the same club. regardless of the fact that we might fucking hate each other. We're all part of the same team. We must rally against the other guys. And so I think part of the problem with the left is that they hate the West. You know, that Americans are, you know, the great Satan, and that Israel is the little-sized Satan. And they don't like Western values. And jihadists don't like Western values either. It's not clear to me how those lefties would fare under, you know, a jihadist republic. And I do think one way to cure people of this is to let them see for themselves. As I gave the example of the ANC student who went to Israel, kind of saw for himself. You know, I'd say, go and do a trip to these places. Go and see, you know, how well women's rights are respected in these countries, if that's what you care about. Go and tell people that you're gay and see how that goes down. You know, you'll suddenly find that reality is a hard thing to face. There's these great stories of people who were sympathetic to, you know, to communism, who went out to North Korea to go and see it for themselves. They didn't ever get to leave, though, unfortunately. They rotted to death in prisons. And I imagine that would be the fate of many of the Coloradans who would go and visit Ramallah or Nablus. Yeah, I think seeing for yourself would give you a good idea of what you actually have to face.
All right, Mark, thanks so much for joining me. Yeah, it's been great.
Absolute pleasure.